everyone. I'm Lynn Joffe, producer of the award-winning Solid Gold Storytime podcast, and it is my absolute delight to have in the studio with me Chomolemo Moachi, writer of Bontle's New Wheels. Welcome, Chomo.
Hi, Lynn. Thank you so much for inviting me to the Solid Gold podcast.
It's absolutely wonderful. I met you at a UNESCO meeting in Pretoria where you read your book. Was that the first time that you were reading it in front of an audience, or are you used to reading the actual text?
It was the first time reading it in front of the audience. For the first time, as I was reading it out to people, it wasn't in the making, you know, during the process of making a book where you have to read the book and check if all is in order. So it was an experience that, it was emotional, but also emotional in the sense that it kind of gave me that surreal feeling that, oh, this is it. This is real.
This is real.
This is real, right? Because for the longest time, I had been dreaming about that moment. But now seeing it happen, it was just, wow, it was like a dream. So yes, it was the first time.
So this is now the second time. We've just finished recording the Sesotho version, which is called
Setulo sa Mabidi sa Bontle se Setsha.
And in English?
Bontle's New Wheels.
Okay. The book is about a young girl, a seven-year-old girl, who is in a wheelchair. What led you to write this particular story?
So this book is based on my true story or life event that happened 4 years ago. And my wheelchair broke down. And I was fortunate enough that I was getting into my house the time that happened. And leading to that moment, I was still going through the most in terms of looking around for funding for a wheelchair, and I was just so disheartened and depressed because I couldn't find anything, right? And then when that happened, it was like a final nail, you know, spanner in the works. I don't know if you'd like to call it. So, yeah, and when that happened, of course, that whole experience, I decided to just take that experience and write it as a children's book. But why I also did that for me, it was because I wanted to have that seven-year-old to see themselves in a children's book, you know, because I didn't see myself in a children's book. And at that time, at that age, 7 years, 6 years, 5 years, I'd only known of books that were of white characters, your Cinderella's, your Snow White. And I had never seen a character that looked like me, you know, skin color and as well as having a disability. So I wanted to just give that seven-year-old out there to see themselves and say to them that they are beautiful. I think also that's why I was very intentional about giving the character the name Bontle. Because for the longest time myself, I didn't see myself as beautiful.
In the climax of the story, mm-hmm. something shifts in the narrative. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe describe what that is and what the message of the story
okay.
contains?
In the climax, a lot of things shifted for me. I mean, the climax for me was when Bontle was the reality of Bontle being stuck in the house, right? And not being able to go out and play with her friends and go to school, which is something that I have experienced myself when I was young. Before even I was 7 years, I would be in the house. I could not go out and play with other kids. So that for me was the climax. But also the climax was a time when Mama Action stepped in. And it's unfortunate that we don't have a lot of Mama Actions out there who help out in this instance, because I was fortunate that Mama Action is actually a true character.
Oh, wow.
A beautiful lady, angel, came through for me. As, like I said, the moment the wheelchair broke, I was crying and I called him and I said, I'm thinking of getting a crowdfunding, because she had asked me to to send a proposal for my plea for the funding, right? And I was crying, and she said to me, no, please don't put it in public yet. Let me just do something. And then I think a week later, the news came in and then said, your wheelchair has been paid off fully.
Right. So she was your fairy godmother?
She was my fairy godmother indeed. And also, yes, I could say that Ilse was also a very imperative part in the story.
So it seems like you actually, in a sense, had two fairy godmothers. One was Mama Action, mm-hmm. who actually made things happen, and the other was Ilse. So tell us a bit about that.
Okay, so with Mama Action, as I've explained, it was her coming through for me. You know, without any judgment, she didn't even hesitate, just jump in and help. The second person to come through for me was Ilse. And that was even before I had spoken to Mama Action. So Ilse, the moment I went into the wheelchair manufacturer shop, I got in there and I was so frustrated and disheartened, you know. And then she helped me out with assessing me for the wheelchair that I need, which is a rare thing that happens in our society is people who are using wheelchairs, right? Because people just assume that you just need a wheelchair, just any type of wheelchair, right? And they just assume that you can just walk into any shop and then just buy a wheelchair and that's it. Because I would have people coming to me as I was going through that process. People would just say to me, no, we know someone who used a wheelchair and they're no longer using it, so we can give you that wheelchair. And I had to explain that that's not how it works, right? And for me, walking in and Ilse being the one to say, okay, let's do the whole assessment, right, to taking me and then giving me the options, even financially, because the moment I pointed to the wheelchair that I felt it was meant for me, she said, okay, but we do have a more affordable option for that one that you want, which is an economic wheelchair. And then she broke down the options for me. And it was a beautiful experience, and having someone who understands you. And I think for me, in most of the Black communities and disability communities, we don't have that where you have an occupational therapist. I mean, I could count the occupational therapists that I know who are Black, actually. Maybe now I think there is a rise, but then when I was still a child, before I even went to school, there wasn't many. And to have someone who to say, okay, these are the things, these are the tools that I can help you with so that you can be able to achieve your goal, you know? And I think that's what I would love to see more in our communities. And other thing is the financial aspect of it, where even if they are occupational therapists, but they're costly, which is another obstacle that we need to speak about.
Okay, so in a kind of a way, it's almost, I wouldn't call it activism light, but the message of your own life experience as transformed into a children's story still holds that message about people who are in disadvantaged communities, who are disabled, that you're almost opening it up to a child and parent audience for that kind of awareness. Was that part of why you wrote the book?
Yes, that was exactly the reason why I wrote the book, because there was never a platform or a space for that conversation, you know. And because a lot of people think that kids are unaware of people with disabilities, and because them not knowing about people with disabilities, actually the adults are all right, adults know. But I've come to realize that adults are more the ones who have no idea at all. And a bit of some ableist remarks and thoughts come from adults as well, because even in the healthcare system, you know, you'd find most of my friends went through health workers who would say, I mean, if maybe a friend or someone is looking for family planning, you would be asked why, because you've got a disability, right? And not considering the fact that you're just as human as them. So it for me, it was also opening up that conversation, even in a friendlier way, of course, because I feel that kids are also curious. They want to know, but they're never given that opportunity because parents will just somehow block them, you know, as they want to know. So they will just block them because of their scared, I think, that probably they will be offending me if they're asking me questions. So that was for me a thing to say, okay, how do I address this?
Tell us how you wrote the book. Did you start off in English and then move to Sesotho? Or how is your writing process in terms of the language you use?
I've been very intentional about writing in Sesotho. Even my poems, I write in Sesotho. As I wrote the book, both in English and Sesotho. I had to always mirror the two. If the Sesotho matches with the English, if the English matches with the Sesotho. So I had to work on both languages, right? It was a beautiful challenge. It's something that I don't think I'd want to do.
Do any tunes come to you? Do you think in poetic terms or musical terms, or is it the words on the page?
It was words on the page. And it was a beautiful experience also because it kind of took me back to
the inner
to
child.
Being in the class in high school or in primary when I would write in Sesotho and read novels. You know, even I remember when I was in grade 9, grade 8 actually, I read a friend's book who was in grade 10, the novel that they were using in grade 10 class. I read it and I was in grade 8. And I remember our teacher, grade 8 teacher, asking, so have you guys been reading Sesotho texts? And my friend actually said, yes, my friend has been referring to me, has been reading a book, a grade 10 book, and she finished the whole book. And my teacher was actually impressed. Wow, really, you know, because I just loved just being engulfed or enveloped in that situation where I would just read in Sesotho.
Given that you have a disability, I think everyone in a sense has something that disables them internally. I want to know what gives you the drive, the energy, and the passion because of and maybe in spite of the fact that you do have a physical disability since a child.
Yeah, I think, you know, I could speak for all of us despite one having a disability or not. An inner child is one. A child is actually someone who's fearless, someone who's curious, someone who dreams and has no obstacles to their dreams, right? So I think for me, it was taking myself back there, back to that moment every time when I get discouraged on whatever I would dream of. Because I knew I would be watching a lot of TV. And that time, TV had the best content. I mean, you'd have your Fundani Nati by Mamnandi Nyembe. You'd have African storytelling shows by Mamgcina Mhlophe, you know, and also many other kiddies shows that were very educational. So I would see that world and I would see myself getting into it, saying, okay, I can't wait to be famous. Well, in my head, I just thought I wanted to be on TV, right? And I wanted to do such great things as the figures that I've counted. And as you grow, of course, as I grew up, I didn't actually realize I went through a series of events of bullying. And that kind of killed my spirit so much because I started dimming that voice, you know, like just that I'm not the best that I thought I am. So it took a lot. And even today, I must say that, of course, I'm going for therapy. I'm getting into a space where I quieten those voices that make me feel like I'm not good enough because, yeah, there will be those moments, but I just never, I try to take myself back to that little girl who dreamed a lot, who would take a book and just write and believe in writing and drawing.
So in other words, your inner life has always been very rich tied into your love of reading. Would that be accurate?
Absolutely. The first person to teach me how to read was my mother. Mm. She taught me to read using the Cinderella book. From then on, even when I went to school, I felt safe enough in the classroom because I was living in boarding school. So I would be safe in the class because there were books and the teachers who would affirm me a lot because they could see that I really do love reading and they would encourage me. And that's how I became more confident in public speaking, you know, poetry. And yeah, I've always loved reading.
Your book has been published by New Africa Books. Congratulations. And there's a launch and you are going to be as famous as you want. So may you get what you want. Just give us an idea of the passage from you finished the book and now you've got a published book. What happened between those two points?
Just before I answer the question, I actually don't think I want to be famous anymore.
Well, tough luck to that.
Okay, the process was, so I did my research, spoke to, because I was already in the storytelling industry or in the literary industry, if I put it like that. And I would ask my closest family in the literary space for guidance on their experiences, on what it takes to write a children's book, to publish, kinds of publishing. And at first, I thought I wanted to do the self-publishing. So that's when my great mother in the literary space said to me, try just looking into getting a publisher first before you consider self-publishing. And that's when I met Tushanka. We met at Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers. And yeah, she asked me to send her the manuscript and she will get back to me. And then that's how the journey started. And yeah, that's when I published.
Fabulous. You've told me that you're involved in storytelling, in poetry, in literature. Give us a little bit of a taste of that and the fact that you actually do a lot of that creative work in Sesotho.
Okay. So how I started officially writing in Sesotho was I was approached by one of my mothers in the literary space again, who had a festival in the Eastern Cape, and she was writing a book. And she asked me to write a poem to be inserted in the book, right, to be an insert in the book. And I wrote the poem, and she specifically asked me, she said, can you please write the poem in Sesotho? And that was like a greatest challenge because I had really been writing in English for the longest time. And then when she said that, I said, okay, let me do it. And then I did it, handed over to my high school teacher to edit. And then he liked it. He said, actually, this is beautiful work, right? From then on, that Sesotho poem, what happened was I posted it on Facebook after the publication of the book. And a lady from Kenya residing in London, another beautiful mother of mine in the literary space, Prof. Wangui Wangoro, she asked me, she saw the insert on Facebook. And we hadn't met, but we'd just been Facebook friends. And she said, I would like for you to read this book as part of our festival. It was during COVID, so it was virtual. She said, I will give you my place. I don't have to say anything in the festival. I'll give you my place for you to read your poem because I would love for you to read your poem to us. And then you can explain more the translation to us. And I did that, right? And from then on, she invited me. She was curating a festival in Berlin, the Berlin Transnational Festival, right? She asked me to be part of the collective of African writers who participated in the festival. And it was strictly African languages. We had so many beautiful African languages.
Did you go to Berlin?
I did. I went to Berlin and, wow. She actually said, because we are going to be opening the festival, she would like for me to write more poems to read in the Sesotho. And then that's when I wrote all the other poems that I have in Sesotho. And yeah, got the poems in Berlin. So yes, my poems already touched the ground in Berlin.
You've also spoken about your mothers, your almost your literary mothers. So it's a very much a feminine, female mentorship or inspiration that you gain from maybe older women, maybe sometimes younger women, but from women who encourage each other, who lift each other up.
Yes, I've been so fortunate enough that I've been enveloped and mentored by powerful black women, right? And old women actually as well. Because
hey, hey, careful.
Old in a sense, okay, maybe I must say a wise lived woman, you know, because I think for me, the important thing is, you know, when people think of old, they think offensive or sort of like an insult. But for me, sitting in the feet of people who are old, it's the most magical thing to happen, because you get to be fed gems of wisdom, right? And I wouldn't have it any other way. Like, I just love sitting at the feet of the old woman, because there's a Sesotho saying that we say, Baholo rutang bana ditaole lisi ka tsona badimo, which means elders teach the kids their ways. Loosely translated, that's not actually so. Ditaola, it's more of the bones that are used by traditional healers. So teach the kids that wisdom so that you don't take it to the graves. And for me, it's so important, because I feel that without having that, we get lost along the way and we lose our sense of selves.
Continuity. And it's beautiful. And because we're crossing cultures now and it's taken us so long, I hope to be one of those old women upon whose feet you sit, and maybe you'll be the old woman upon whose feet I sit.
Oh, thank you so much.
So it's a beautiful thing. Khomolema Moagi, thank you for joining us. Good luck and good talent and good vibes. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.